Clerk will call the docket.
Felipe Melendez, Estevia, against Superintendent Rappahannock Regional Jail, Johnson B. Sheldon, the appellant, John C. Johnson, the appellant.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is John Sheldon. I represent Mr. Escamilla. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Felipe Escamilla Melendez came to this country in 1999 as a legal permanent resident. 4 years later, at the age of 19, he was charged with four crimes, a felony grand larceny for stealing a CD player from a car, and three misdemeanors of tampering with a car. At that time, his attorney gave him the wrong advice about the immigration consequences. His attorney told him when he asked that if you serve a year or less, there will be no consequences, but that's incorrect. If you have a suspended sentence of a year or less, there will be immigration consequences. If Homeland Security had seized Mr. Escamilla within the following year when he was released, then he would have been able to vindicate that violation of his Sixth Amendment right. He would have had, under this statute, the Virginia habeas statute, clearly he would have been in custody because he would have been on probation or parole. He would have had a suspended sentence. And there would have been no problem. But Homeland Security did not charge him for 10 years. So 10 years later, there's a knock on his door early in the morning, as often happens. He was seized, and he was brought into
detention. The obvious problem is he was not in custody at the time of the habeas petition. Either on the conviction, he was not under a parole or a suspended sentence or a probation term. Isn't that the real issue in the case?
Yes, that's right. That's the real issue. The real issue is whether his seizure and his being put in the Rappahannock Jail under this Homeland Security detention is detention sufficient for custody. That is the real issue in this case. But the statute makes clear, the Virginia statute makes clear that this is not one of those instances where he's not in jail, he's not a suspended sentence. And the question for this court is, when there is a clear, absolute violation of a constitutional right, and the petitioner, through no fault of his own, in fact, it is the very constitutional violation which prevented his discovering of it, how may one vindicate that right? And Mr. Escamilla suggested to the circuit court, and we suggested this court, that there are serious problems if you don't allow any vindication of a constitutional right under these circumstances.
But since the 17th century, the vindication has been habeas. And if habeas is inapplicable, there's nothing to vindicate.
Well, that's not quite right, Your Honor. There have been many. The problem we have in Virginia is stingier than any state or the federal government in vindication of constitutional rights. In fact, when this statute was passed, there was quorum vobis in Virginia. There is still quorum nobis in every state I practice in and in the federal government. If this happened on the George Washington Parkway in Arlington, I would have filed a quorum nobis petition in federal court, and he would have been able to vindicate his right. But after the statute was passed, this court, in Ray Morris, said no quorum vobis, no auditor corella, and unlike virtually every other state, there is no statutory method for bringing post-conviction challenges except for habeas. And so this
there's the actual innocence statute.
Excuse me?
There's the actual innocence statute.
That's right. This is not an innocence case. We're not claiming innocence. We're claiming, the facts here are clear. There is an absolute clear violation of the Sixth Amendment right. There is no way he could have discovered it prior to being released from the jail. He couldn't, it was really up to Homeland Security. Homeland Security had detained him. Within the year, he would have been able to vindicate this violation. In EC, the case where the petitioner filed his petition, then he was released from Department of Juvenile Justice custody. And the question before this court was, now he's released. He's not in detention. He doesn't have a suspended sentence. Are you going to find custody? And this court said yes. And one of the reasons this court said yes is because otherwise it would provide the Department of Juvenile Justice the ability to control jurisdiction over habeas.
Isn't EC distinguishable because it was state parole jurisdiction?
I don't think he was on parole. I think...
Parole supervision.
I don't think so. I think the issue in EC was that EC was out of custody. And that's why this court had to reach that question of, well, at the time it was filed, he was clearly in custody. So what are we going to do when custody ceases while a petition is pending?
And this court said... Is there no longer any supervision after that custody?
That's right.
In EC?
Yes.
Okay.
And EC had to register as a sex offender?
Yes, that's right.
Which is what one of the reasons the court found that there was habeas jurisdiction?
I don't think it was because... I think the sex offender registry was not really related to the jurisdiction, but it was related to the mootness question. Is this issue moot? And so the jurisdictional question was solely
that... He was still under supervision. It is distinguishable for that reason, is it not?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think you're incorrect. The EC was not under supervision. There was two separate questions, jurisdiction and mootness. The mootness question, this court found it's not moot because of the sex offender registry. But for jurisdiction, the reason why that was a difficult case is because he was under supervision at the time it was filed, and there was no supervision while the case was pending. And for two reasons, this court said that we're going to find jurisdiction. The first is that EC had no control over how long this habeas case took. So we're going to find that as long as he was detained at the time it was filed, there's jurisdiction. And the second problem was this court didn't want to give the Department of Juvenile Justice the ability to eliminate jurisdiction by, when somebody filed a habeas petition, releasing somebody from custody.
I'm a little confused by your answer to Justice Mims' question. It seems to me that in EC, the deciding factor for jurisdiction is that he was under parole supervision when he filed.
Correct.
Okay.
When he filed.
The question
of this case is not like EC. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying two principles from EC are applicable to this case.
And the question of custody, of course, is one of the issues, but you have a statute of limitations problem if it's not custody, or if it even if it is one way or the other. But you also have an equitable tolling argument. Are you going to get to that before the Commonwealth responds?
Yeah, so the jurisdiction and the timing are somewhat related, but they're different problems, right? And this court has never found the equitable tolling for the habeas statute. You never have. In every case that's come before this court, the recent case of Hicks, this court found that 801-229-D gave a petitioner who brought his petition years after the statute of limitations that a separate statute, because it was a Brady violation, gave him the ability. As far as I'm quite certain, Hicks is the only case that this court has found an exception to the statute of limitations. And there's no other case that I'm aware of where this court has found any exception. We, of course, filed well after the statute of limitations. And the issue for this court, I think, which has avoided in all the other cases you've addressed it, is was it Mr. Escamilla's fault? And if it wasn't, are you going to allow some remedy to vindicate this constitutional right? Of course, for years, there were remedies. Before this statute was passed, there was habeas. After the statute was passed, there was quorum vobis. There was auditor corelli. Now there is nothing.
Well, counsel, on the jurisdiction question, how do you get past what we said in Smith versus Holland, which is that jurisdiction is limited to consideration of the validity of the conviction under which the petitioner was being detained?
Well, I think since Smith versus Holland, of course, this court has changed its language and its analysis of custody. As long as the order would release...
This is not about custody. This is limited to challenging the conviction under which the petitioner was detained. You're not challenging that, right?
We're challenging...
He was being detained
correct.
By...
I don't think there's any issue that we're challenging that this conviction is unconstitutional in order to get out of the INS custody. There's no question.
But what you're being asked is historically has always been a nexus between the detention and the attacked conviction.
That's right.
There's no nexus here. The detention here is immigration detention.
Of course, I would disagree strongly. There's a strong nexus. It's just different. it's further apart than this court has ever allowed.
Well, let me stop you there. He was detained. Was he detained by state officials based upon his state conviction, a violation of parole, a violation of probation, or a suspended sentence being revoked?
No,
we all understand what's the nexus between his immigration detention?
The nexus is that if this court or the circuit court issues an order finding that his conviction was unconstitutional, that order, standing alone, will release him from his custody. Is the nexus the same as this court has found in previous cases? No, absolutely not. There's no question about that. There's no question that I'm asking this court to reach an issue that it hasn't reached previously, which is, if there's no doubt that his Sixth Amendment rights were violated, and it's not his fault that he did not bring this case sooner, is there any ability to vindicate that right? And I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is John Johnson. I appear before you today for the superintendent. The court correctly noted that under the first assignment of error that custody in habeas is jurisdictional. The facts are clear before this court. All forms of criminal detention for Escamilla, active incarceration, suspended incarceration, and probation were terminated some 8 years before the filing of this petition. Now, Mr. Escamilla argues that there was no practical distinction regarding the effect of the writ on Escamilla's release, whether he was detained based on his criminal convictions in 2003 or based on the INS detainer. In other words, what difference does it make? Respectfully, the superintendent argues otherwise. Admittedly, this court has not squarely addressed the specific issue of whether being in custody for an immigration proceeding amounts to such detention sufficient for state jurisdiction. But what is clear is that Escamilla's custody, pursuant to the federal proceeding, was not any part of the sentence imposed by the Commonwealth as punishment for the 2003 conviction. The immigration proceeding by the federal government was not a penalty imposed by the Commonwealth. As noted earlier by the bench, Your Honors, this court has held in Smith v. Holland that the circuit court's jurisdiction in considering the habeas matters is limited to a consideration of the validity of the conviction under which the prisoner was being detained.
But don't we have cases that have basically modified that rule? How about Smith v. Mitchell?
I don't think it has modified the rule so much, Your Honor, Smith v. Holland is still very good law in the law of the Commonwealth. And I would distinguish that because we have other courts who have consistently held, including the United States Supreme Court, in interpreting the federal habeas statute, 28 U.S.C. 2254 and 2255, that the petitioner must be in custody under the conviction of the sentence under attack at the time his petition was filed. That's the Mullane v. Cook case, cited with approval in E.C. And while we're talking about E.C.,
but that's the federal statute. I mean, we said in Smith v. Midget at page 730, however, he may attack in a habeas corpus proceeding the validity of a sentence he has completely served when he is detained as a repeat offender.
Detained as a repeat offender, which would be the nexus back to the original conviction.
It's a nexus back to it, but he's not serving the original sentence, and the original sentence has been completely served.
It has, but I think we're still talking different issues here because being a repeat offender of the same predicate offense underlying his original conviction versus an INS detainer, which, courts...
He's being detained because of his previous sentence.
He's being detained because he's no longer qualified as a result of the
conviction. Right, so there's a nexus.
But I do not think, Your Honor, that it is sufficient enough to relate back to afford state court habeas jurisdiction, and that's consistent with what courts throughout this land have found. The Minnelli Court, the federal court in the Eastern District, in passing on a federal case after this court declined to accept a writ, dismissed the federal habeas petition where the petitioner was an immigrant facing deportation. In that situation, plaintiff's relevant state conviction had expired more than 2 years, not 8 years, four times as much. Similar result was, and I'm going to massacre this name as I say it, I'm going to apologize in advance, the Ogunwumaju case from the Second Circuit is another case where one was held in immigration detention. He's not in custody, as in custody is defined for the purpose of challenging state convictions under 2254. Cases from the 5th, the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th Circuit, all similar outcomes, all holding that immigration detention was separate and apart from custody for the purposes of challenging state court habeas jurisdiction. So the habeas court below properly held that Escamilla was not in custody at the time of the filing of his petition when this occurred. It was 8 years prior. Now, moving on to the second assignment of error, whether the petition's time barred. The habeas court properly held that it was time barred, and the court keyed on the constitutional argument. It's well settled that the General Assembly has provided absolutely no exceptions, and statutes of limitations are generally strictly enforced. The superintendent contends that there's really no basis for the application of equitable estoppel for the reasons that we cite in our brief. One claiming equitable estoppel has to show by clear, precise, and unequivocal evidence that he relied to his detriment upon an act or statement of the other party to refrain. There's no act or statement on the part of the Commonwealth to refrain from taking action within the statutory period. Mr. Escamilla argues that 8.01.654 violates the Virginia Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, dealing with the prohibition against the suspension of the privilege of the writ. But statutes of limitations have long held to be constitutional, and this is no exception. At the time Escamilla entered his plea, he knew his immigration status. He had the facts necessary to recognize the alleged constitutional violation. He knew the facts, but perhaps not their legal significance. At the time, he had a right to pursue a habeas action, but he did not do so. And it is quite paradoxical that the petitioner is blaming the government for not arresting him sooner. Had they acted 10 years before they did? Petitioner argues that because Escamilla did not discover during the 2 years following his conviction, the statute should not apply to him. This is akin to like a discovery rule case that the court has addressed many times in the context of a toxic tort, for example. But in analyzing this, the court has to analyze it under the framework that all actions of the General Assembly are presumed constitutional. And so we can't declare an enactment unconstitutional only unless it is clearly repugnant to some provision of either the state or federal constitution. And any doubt must be resolved in favor of its validity.
Counsel, has any court, as far as you know, in the nation held that a statute of limitations imposed upon a habeas right of action was somehow a legislative suspension of the ancient right of habeas?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. If there is, I did not come across it. I'm aware of no Virginia law. Now, the court came close to dealing with this issue in Hines versus Kaplinsky. And in that case, it's interesting because Mr. Escamillo's argument, like Mr. Hines, failed because the record does not support the underlying predicate for the claimed right to a late filed petition, that he was unable to discover the basis for his claims because of ineffective assistance of counsel. And as this court did in Hines, in the absence of a record establishing this factual predicate, the court need not, and the superintendent contends, should not reach that question. The court will recall that in Hines, Mr. Hines knew of certain exculpatory testimony from certain witnesses, but did not act upon it within the time provided under the habeas statute. Had he taken action, within that time, perhaps he would have become aware of the of Mr. Hines' alleged ineffective assistance of counsel. He did not. At the time Escamilla entered his plea, he was armed with the knowledge of his immigration status, but again, perhaps not of its legal significance. He had the facts necessary to recognize an alleged constitutional violation, but again, not of the legal significance. Your Honors, that, at this point in time, that concludes my argument. I have 5 minutes remaining.
Let,
if the court
let me
elections.
Ask
yes, ma'am.
A question, counsel. Yes, if Mr. Escamilla was still in state custody, if he were locked up in one of the regional jails, and he brought this claim, my attorney told me I had no immigration consequences. Obviously, I did. INS is knocking on the door, and he would have a valid habeas claim.
That is correct, sir.
Wait a minute. Hold on.
Wait a minute.
Oh, hold on. Wouldn't it make a difference what he's being held for?
Assuming he's being held on the charge that he is about which he is complaining.
That was the assumption
yes,
I took into the question.
That
my
was
apologies.
Implicit to, between you and me, Justice Lemon. So your argument is he was given bad advice, he's being held on that charge. If he were still in jail, he would have a remedy. But because he has now been deported, he has absolutely no remedy.
Because he, at the time the petition was filed.
Let me be clear. Because he is no longer under state control, no probation, no parole, he's been deported, there is no remedy because of those two factors.
The conviction cannot be attacked in a habeas proceeding under those circumstances. And I want to make sure I understand the court's question. Because he was deported raised the issue that the court asked us to address in supplemental letter briefs of whether it was moot. And conceivably, we do not think that it was mooted by the fact that he has now been deported.
Because of the denial of reentry. Because of the potential denial of reentry.
Exactly. And were this 2003 conviction totally removed, then assuming he meets all other criteria for reentry, assuming there's no intervening bad conduct.
So your position is he's not in custody, number one.
Number one.
Number two, statute of limitations has run.
Exactly.
It's not a suspension of the writ, and there's no such thing as equitable tolling for a case like this.
Under these facts, there's no such position for equitable tolling. That would be our position.
One last question. Does the United States Attorney General have discretion in any aspect of the INS decision-making?
Oh, gosh.
That Latin.
as far as the position of the of the Attorney General for the United States, it would certainly be our assumption that they can operate using their very broad swath of prosecutorial discretion,
which in several instances is actually codified in the immigration statute.
It has been codified in the, I'm not sure of the statute, but I would certainly say in the rules promulgated by the agency.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
I think it's clear that if this court rules for Mr. Escamilla, it will be a different ruling than what this court has done in the past. It will be that there is a nexus that is further away than this court has found previously. But there is an issue here that I think this court has to address.
Let's say we wanted to do that and that we felt that we could do that. Get over the equitable tolling hurdle.
Well, for equitable tolling, the question is always, is the petitioner somehow sat on his rights. And in this case, no, there's the no issue, evidence
the
whatsoever.
The issue is detrimental reliance. Has he relied to his detriment on some action by the state?
Well, in federal equitable tolling, there's equitable tolling when you rely on your attorney's misadvice and he's told you he's going to do something and he doesn't do it. So federal equitable tolling for habeas purposes is much broader than blaming the state.
So we have to really go into uncharted territory twice to...
I don't think so. In this case, his attorney, the constitutional violation in this case is different from many. The constitutional violation that opposing counsel had suggested is one in which the petitioner knows about the hidden evidence.
Okay,
he just doesn't bring it.
I'm just going to recite from our precedent, not federal precedent, ours. A claimant must show by clear, precise, and unequivocal evidence that he relied to his detriment upon an act or statement of the other party, not of his attorney.
That's not this case, Your Honor. That's correct.
So we have to go into uncharted territory twice
because you say in this case there's no allegation in any way that the petitioner is to blame in any way for his failure to discover this constitutional violation until Homeland Security decided to knock on his door at 4 a.m. in 10 years later. There is no allegation that he is at fault in any way for his failure to discover this constitutional violation, and therefore there are difficulties that this court has to face, which is it going to be a suspension of the writ to say in a case where a petitioner, through no fault of his own, has not discovered the constitutional violation, there is no remedy. And the reason why there are no other cases...
Counsel, is it that there's no remedy or that there's no remedy in front of this panel? For example, and this was the frustration that at least this member of the court had when we first dealt with this whole line of cases. The federal executive, the state executive, the federal legislature, and the state legislature each could provide a remedy. And for reasons that go beyond anything that we are arguing over today, none of them have provided that remedy in this particular case.
I don't think so, Your Honor. Okay. And in this way, quorum vobis is a judicial-created remedy. And when this statute was passed, quorum vobis existed. People were using quorum vobis just for this situation. In federal court, this is what we use quorum vobis for when the statute is passed. Equitable tolling is much broader. But we are successful in federal court bringing quorum nobis. Quorum vobis existed in Virginia for this situation when this habeas statute was passed. There were remedies. Slowly, these remedies are being extinguished. And as far as I know, and everywhere I practice in many states, this is the only state where there's not another statutory remedy besides habeas, as well as it's the only state where auditor Corella cannot... Well, auditor Corella is limited, but several states allow auditor Corella. Quorum nobis is used in every state. This is the only state that I know of, including the federal government, where there are no other remedies except for habeas. And the reason why there are no decisions about suspension of the writ is because there are other possibilities for remedies, and you either win or lose on the merits. But here, there's no hearing on the merits in Virginia. And I think for those reasons, for suspension of the writ reasons, then an EC, because habeas should be liberally construed, it's a remedial statute, it's not static, it's not narrow, it's not formalistic, this court should reach the merits of this case.
Counsel, let me ask a quick question about collateral consequences. We said in EC that collateral consequences can defeat a mootness claim, but what you're asking us to do, I think, I just want to make sure I'm clear about this, that to say collateral consequences can actually constitute detention to provide a basis for a habeas petition, right? I mean, that's where we have...
Well, I wouldn't call these collateral. These are direct consequences. Padilla versus Kentucky says this collateral, direct... they said we're not getting into... These are direct consequences, okay. Not collateral.
All right, counsel, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Call the next case.